Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The U.S. Department of Energy is responsible for advancing the energy, environmental, and nuclear security of the United States, promoting scientific and technological innovation in support of that mission, sponsoring basic research in the physical sciences, and ensuring the environmental cleanup of the nation's nuclear weapons complex. To be successful in these areas involves better aligning mission support functions with mission delivery. Given the critical challenges facing government today, the ability of government executives to properly align mission support with mission delivery can help them respond more effectively to their mission and management challenges, as well as driving change within their departments. What are the key management and operational challenges facing energy? How is energy progressing in its environmental management cleanup efforts? What are the department's IT goals and priorities? And how is energy changing the way it does mission support? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy. Well, David, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Great. Thanks. Glad to be here.
David, many of our listeners are generally familiar with the Department of Energy as an organization. But before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you can give us a brief overview of the history and continued evolution of energy's mission. When was energy created?
Well, the Energy Department actually was born during World War II as the Manhattan Project. Actually, President Roosevelt started it in response to a letter from Albert Einstein. A group of nuclear scientists, many of them based at the University of California, moved forward on an initiative to develop the first nuclear weapons as a way to bring a swift end to the war. Sort of the core elements of that were the sort of the development of nuclear weapons in Los Alamos and the production of uranium for that purpose in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and the production of plutonium in Hanford, Washington. Over time, the department's mission has evolved, and we really now have about four major missions. One of them continues to be the national security mission of the department. We are, as the Department of Energy, the civilian entity responsible for the development and management of nuclear weapons. A second major component, and it comes in many respects out of, but is very much broader than the nuclear security mission, is that the Department of Energy is the home of the basic science research within the U.S. government. And it is everything from where the universe came from to providing the amazing scientific tools that no single entity could afford, but which everyone needs, such as high-performance scientific tools that allow you to look inside molecules and atoms and viruses, et cetera, and develop new medicines, develop new materials, et cetera. And we have 17 national laboratories spread across the country, which both do very fundamental and important research themselves, but also provide scientific tools for our economy and for the rest of the world. The third mission of the department is the applied energy missions of the department. We have offices of fossil energy, nuclear energy, energy efficiency and renewable energy, EERE. And these are applied energy programs where we try and both support some of basic research in those areas, but also try and move these technologies forward, whether it's through appliance efficiency standards in EERE, helping with the development of wind and energy technology, providing grants for small nuclear reactor developments, et cetera. The third mission is really this applied energy mission, and that, as you know, we are the Department of Energy, and that's core to it. The fourth of those missions is the environmental management mission, because over the 60 years of full production of the nuclear weapons, our complex produced an enormous amount of nuclear waste and materials, and it is going to take us 40 to 50 years to clean those up. So in many respects, that is a mission unto itself. And those really are sort of the four core missions of what the department does.
So, David, with such a broad and complex mission set, could you give us a sense of the scale of operation? You kind of alluded to it, of the department. And where I'm going is, how is it organized? What's the size of its budget, number of FTEs, and more particularly its geographical footprint?
Well, we have about 13,500 federal employees and 104,000 contractor employees. The department operates very much through management and operation contracts for the national laboratories, but we also operate under contract the facilities that produce and manage and basically work on the nuclear weapons. Our footprint is across the entire United States. We actually have land territory larger than the state of Delaware, if you put it all together. Some of our facilities up in Idaho is over 900 square miles. And so we manage just an enormous, enormous resource. I think just to perhaps give you some sense of the scale of it, and this is actually sort of referring back to the time when the department was the primary, its primary mission was the development of materials for nuclear weapons. We consumed approximately 10% of the electric power produced in the United States. Wow. That power was necessary for the production facilities that served that mission. I think our budget is about $28, $29 billion. And about $7.5 billion of that is in the Office of Management and Performance, which of which I'm the Deputy Undersecretary.
That's a great transition. So what about your role as Energy's Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance? Could you tell us what your specific responsibilities and duties are? And how do you support the overall mission of the department?
Well, that's actually a good way to describe it. We are the department's primary mission support organization. And what you would think of as mission support organizations for a cabinet department reside within the Office of Management and Performance. Secretary Moniz, when he came to office almost a year and a half ago, reorganized the department to try and pull together those primary support functions for the department. So we include, for example, the Chief Human Capital Officer. We include the Chief Information Office. We include the primary support functions for environmental protection, health, safety, and security of our workers and the public that surrounds our facilities. And if you go back and understand what our missions are, you'll appreciate the importance of maintaining nuclear safety and security and worker protection. Other offices include what we call the Office of Management that includes the project management expertise and acquisition and procurement expertise that sets policies and provides support to the programs across the department that actually implement the missions of the department. But in addition to that, we also have the Office of Environmental Management, which, as I described earlier, is about a $5.8 billion per year cleanup of the nuclear waste that resides across our complex. So that it's really the combination of what you would think of as the mission support organizations plus environmental management. And we have a small office called Legacy Management that actually oversees the sites that we and the Army Corps of Engineers clean up. There's about 200 of those across the country where we've actually accomplished cleanup and we manage those sites.
So, David, given your portfolio of responsibilities, it's kind of like you alluded to this, but I'd like you to be more specific about some of your top challenges, say your three top challenges you face in your position, and how have you sought to address them?
Again, just sort of in this case, looking really at the Office of Management and Performance, one of our top challenges is project management. The management of the cleanup of the nuclear waste, we have made a commitment in a number of locations, both in the Savannah River and in Hanford, Washington, and also in Idaho. We've made a commitment in two of those locations actually to take this high-level waste, very toxic, radiologically hot waste, and to glassify it. And what that does is it accomplishes two objectives. One is it puts it into a safe form for disposal, but it also renders it completely unusable for future weapons purposes, consistent with the non-proliferation. To do that, we have facilities that really are quite expensive. We have a facility that we are developing and building up in Hanford that is about a $12.2 billion complex of facilities, one of which handles the low-level waste, one handles high-level waste, one does pretreatment. Each one of those are massive industrial facilities. We have similar facilities down in Savannah River, in Idaho, and that's just the major capital projects, if you will, that our Office of Management and Performance has, the National the NNSA, our Nuclear Weapons Management Office itself has two or three other major projects. One of the great challenges that the department faces is managing these projects. They are one-of-a-kind projects. The technical challenges, there is no place else in the world are they dealing with these materials and trying to process them. And so we have great technical challenges and also construction challenges. So I would say number one challenge from a management standpoint is to improve the project management of those facilities, and that is a priority of the secretaries as well. I'd say a second challenge for us in a management context is our workforce. Mm-hmm. We probably, I would say somewhere between around a fourth of our workforce is eligible to retire within 5 to 7 years. And we're actually finding that employees are retiring, that sort of the wave of retirements that we previously had expected and that was that and that hadn't appeared in the last couple of years is actually coming around. As I've sometimes said, you know, when your 401k is a 201k, you don't retire. But the economy's come back. And so actually this year so far in this year, and we're in September, we've actually had as many retirements as we did in the previous 2 years, each of the previous 2 years. So tendency for many employees is when they retire, they do so at the end of the year. We think that this wave of retirements is going to continue and build. If you look at the demographics of our workforce, that's going to happen. And these really are people who've spent their careers at the department, and many of them are senior leaders. They're nuclear scientists. They're managers. There are real technical expertise. And I'd say second great challenge I'd put would be really workforce management and dealing with the challenges of putting together the workforce that we want in the future.
So along with these challenges that you've encountered, leading such a critical mission support portfolio can be fraught with unanticipated and unexpected surprises. I'd be interested, since you've taken this role over, what has surprised you most?
Well, this is actually my second time at the department. I was the head of the Office of Management back at the end of the Clinton administration when Bill Richardson was secretary, and I sometimes describe myself as a recidivist. In some respects, the department's actually become, in between the time that I was here and the time that I'm here now, the department's actually become more fractured a little bit. I think it's become more siloed than it was, at least in terms of some of the management functions. When I was previously here, we had a very central human capital function, and now some of that authority and the responsibility for doing those human capital functions has been spread out amongst the programs. And what I think we're finding is a somewhat inefficient way. I previously had not, when I was in the Office of Management, had not been involved in the environment management portfolio of the department. And so this is my first real time working in the environmental management portfolio. And actually, one of the things that has surprised me is the extent to which it is each of the management of all of our facilities across the country in terms of a cleanup is actually subject to just an enormous number of court orders and mandates and deadlines and regulatory oversight. That's not necessarily a bad thing because the way the federal government works, because of, if you think about what our sites are, is they are large sites with large amounts of waste. They are Superfund sites and subject to the CERCLA, the Superfund law, and regulation under CERCLA, as well as we are waste disposal sites, and those sites are subject to RCRA. And much of the authority for the implementation of those statutes has been passed down to the states. And so you have the unusual circumstance of having the federal government's operation at a massive federal facility being subject to state regulation. And when we have not met deadlines or we are not in compliance with standards, they take us to court. And so you have the federal government in court as the defendant in a case for the enforcement of federal statutory environmental regulations and requirements, where in essence the other side of that suit is the state. And at issue is how we will spend what is often hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. And I think one of the things that has surprised me is I had not appreciated, was the extent to which the complex structure of court orders and agreements and regulatory enforcements has the cleanup mission that the department does subject to all of these varying requirements, as well as the enormous challenge of working with the U.S. Congress to get the funds to be able to meet the commitments that we make. Sort of that, I think sort of that complex structure of dealing with the Congress to try and both be accountable to the Congress, because we are accountable to Congress, dealing with the courts and the court orders and those requirements and meeting those statutory requirements and meeting the expectations of the local communities. That's a really much more complex structure than I'd previously appreciated when I was at the department.
Yeah. So being a self-proclaimed recidivist and a second tour of duty as a leader within energy, I'd like to get a better sense of your leadership style and key principles that have guided your leadership approach. Perhaps you could outline some of those and illustrate them.
Without attributing, you know, sort of one style or another to any particular secretary or any particular cabinet, you know, over the time that I've served in government, I've noticed, I think anyone who's served in government will see that when an administration comes in or a cabinet secretary comes in, they face a choice. And at one end is the question of whether they will try and manage the department with their cadre of political appointees and work with them to try and accomplish the missions of their particular agency or department. And then at the other end of that spectrum is to say we have a set of career civil servants all the way from SES down to, you know, across the board to GSs, et cetera, and contractor employees, and to see them as integral to the way in which you accomplish both the missions of the department and, frankly, the objectives of that particular administration or your particular secretary. Our secretary really believes in utilizing all of the resources of the department and engaging all of our career employees, our career SES, et cetera, and having them really manage and accomplish the objectives that we believe they have and we have. They're, you know, government employees come to work because they believe in the missions of the department. They believe in the missions of government, and we want to engage them and work with them. And if you had to say what's my style or what's my approach to this, it's really to do that. It's that we have tremendously talented people working within the Office of Management Performance. Each of the leaders of the different pieces of organizations that report up to us, from the chief human capital officer to the heads of environmental management to the CIOs, et cetera, we have extremely talented people. And I won't say I don't want to get in the way of them. I'd like to hope we do things together. But sort of my style really is to engage them and work with them and together accomplish the goals of this secretary, of President Obama, and that Congress and the American people have set out for this department to do.
What are the key operational challenges facing the U.S. Department of Energy? We will ask David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy. So, David, recognizing your office is fairly recently created, given government's term, I'd like to get a sense of your key strategic priorities going forward. Would you elaborate on them? How are you shaping the organization? And more importantly, how are you seeking to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the department's operations?
Well, let me go back to something that I said at the beginning, which is that the department operates with 13,500 federal employees and 104,000 contractor employees. We have 17 national laboratories. We have production facilities in Kansas City and Amarillo for part of the nuclear weapons complex. One of the challenges that we have is to operate all of that as a single enterprise. What we have done historically is to operate this very much in what people would call silos. And those silos of, you know, an example, we have not, you know, just for the federal government alone, we have 19 different cell phone contracts with four carriers. Simple examples, we provide human capital services. Actually, this happens to be through 17 to 18 different sites for our federal employees at a cost that, frankly, exceeds that of the government average and the private sector. One of the goals that we have, as I said, to operate as an enterprise, and we've got two or three initiatives that are underway. One is in the human capital area. We are working on what we call the 120-day study in the Strategic Human Capital Program. And what we're trying to do is take those 19 service centers and bring them down to four. And with that, sort of begin the process of being much more efficient in the provision of human capital services across to the feds. We're doing the same thing in terms of our information technology. We also, again, we kind of like it, a 120-day study on our IT structure. And the 120 days gives us a real deadline and a time frame. And we actually met that deadline in both of the human capital and IT studies. And we're now at the point where we have recommendations and we're moving forward to consolidate those, figure out what are the best of those 19 cell phone contracts, for example, and get everybody having an opportunity to use those. The other thing that we've done, and Secretary Moniz has said that he wants to, and I quote him, he wants to reset our relationship with the national laboratories. And part of that is to work with them. And he's created two mechanisms to do that. One is the National Laboratory Policy Council, which is a council of the laboratory directors and the heads of programs and the undersecretaries. And Secretary Moniz chairs that and probably spends about a day a quarter chairing that meeting, which is a significant commitment of his time and energies, and deals with the issues on that on a regular basis. The other structural thing he's done is he's created something called the National Laboratory Operations Board. And that's another sort of cross-cutting board that has membership on the federal side from every one of the programs that has a national laboratory. And then it has representatives of the chief operating officers from the laboratories and the chief research officers from the national laboratories. And that's a board that I actually chair. And we meet monthly. Four of those meetings are in person and take and we spend a day. Oftentimes, we'll stretch it to a day and a half so that when we do it at a national laboratory, we'll be able to all collectively go see the facilities and learn something on site. And the rest of the time, we do it by video conference. But, you know, we are working very much on the infrastructure issues associated with the national laboratory system. We're working on alternative financing mechanisms. We're working on human capital issues. We've got a whole range of different sort of, if you will, frankly, day-to-day nuts and bolts issues where we think we can better integrate both at the federal level within itself and where it involves the laboratories, that we can reset the relationship with the national labs and we can operate as one enterprise. And that really is sort of a core objective of what we're trying to achieve in the management side.
David, I was wondering, mission support, effective mission support is critical to the success of mission delivery. And I was wondering, what are some of the key operational challenges the department, not you, but the department really faces, and could you expand on them?
Well, we talked about the project management operational challenge, and that's a massive operational challenge. From a purely operational standpoint, and I think you talk in terms of support, mission support and the like, we have an office within the Office of Management, Undersecretary for Management and Performance, that's called the Office of Environment, Health, Safety, and Security. We have 104 contractor employees. I would say probably somewhere between 30 and 40,000 of those employees are what the average American would think of as construction workers, okay, or workers in facilities, or someone who's working in a chemical plant or a processing plant, et cetera. And so, if you will, the worker safety issues associated just simply from that, from an operational standpoint, I receive a daily report on it, what we call the incident report, which are literally safety and related incidents that happen across our operation. And it's not uncommon for that to include 4 to 7 different incidents. It could be a forklift tipped over. It could be, you know, some minor industrial accident or something like that. So literally from just when you talk about the complex and you understand what we do, those are some of the operational issues. If you think about it from a management standpoint and the sort of the federal side, I'll go back to this. I think our CIO runs and provides computer and information technology services for our entire complex. Cybersecurity is an enormous challenge. We get hit by hackers trying to break into our system hundreds, if not thousands of times a day. And from an operational standpoint, and remember what we have, this is the department that designs nuclear weapons. And so we have incredibly sensitive information that whether it's state actors or whether it's individuals, and we also have hackers that are after personal information in the same way, you know, that they go after big corporate accounts. We've all heard about, I'm not going to mention them here, but we all know the stores that have been hit by hackers and all the personal information. Hackers come in and they're after the same thing that they're after with regard to personal information in other places. So from an operational standpoint, if you understand the scale of what it is and appreciate what it takes to manage facilities and the landmass the size of the state of Delaware, it's really quite significant.
So attaining mission success requires a sustained commitment to performance-based management and expectation of excellence from headquarters to the field. What are you doing in your office to foster a culture of performance and accountability throughout the department? And what are some of the key success factors for building this kind of culture?
You know, from the standpoint of the workforce issues, there's a lot of talk now about safety culture. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, there's actually an entity called the Defense Nuclear Safety Board, DNFSB, which was created for the purpose of overseeing and looking at nuclear safety within the department. And so we actually have, if you will, a watchdog that looks at our facilities, that goes to our facilities and sites, that looks at things that happen and issues recommendations and specific recommendations. We work closely with the board and obviously where we can, and you know, and implement those recommendations as best we can where we, you know, where we think they are appropriate. I think from the standpoint of a culture of excellence, and go back and think about the scientific mission, et cetera, I think you have to recognize excellence. I think you have to reward excellence. I think we have awards and recognitions from the Secretary's awards on down. But also from the standpoint of, if you will, performance, I think one of the challenges that you face in a management structure, and unfortunately I think it's kind of become a bigger challenge within government, is to try and really be serious about performance management. And one of the things that we've learned from our employee viewpoint survey is that the single greatest factor that discourages employees at the Department of Energy is when they feel that management is not holding a non-performer accountable. It actually drags down the whole in a very significant way. And then, you know, and there's the typical story where you go ahead and someone, finally management, someone in management or a supervisor says, you know, I've had enough of it. I want to get rid of this employee. And you go back and you see 10 years of superior performance reviews. And it totally undercuts your ability to really go forward. Obviously, there's fairness and equity issues, and many of those may well have been earned or they may not have. But what do they say? You know, in Lake Well Be Gone, all the students are above average. And unfortunately, I think we kind of have had a culture within government, and I don't think it's just the Department of Energy, where I don't believe that performance reviews and performance accountability, not just at the senior SES level, but all the way down through the GS scale, I don't know that that's been taken with the seriousness that it should. And I think one of the things that I've hoped that we could do and I've encouraged people to do is to really be serious about the way in which they review employees and they that they treat the employee performance systems that we have. And the systems are great. It's how they're implemented, I think, that they need to be treated with some seriousness. And the other aspect of this is employee feedback. And, you know, the system works if supervisors and managers basically communicate what they really think the performance is. I had an interesting experience. I had one of my managers, a senior SES who manages one of our programs. I did his performance review for the first time in December. And as part of that performance review, I scheduled a 30-minute meeting with him, and we sat down and talked about what I thought had been the strengths of what he'd done over the years, places I thought he could improve, strengths and weaknesses of the program, asked him, you know, said, hey, you know, what are you doing? You know, what do you want to do? Are you in the right place? What, you know, how's your, you know, what can we do to help your career, et cetera, and talked about that. And at the end of it, he said, you know, I've been in government 19 years, and this is the second time that any supervisor of mine has sat down and talked to me about my performance. And the other time it was a 5-minute review. And the other 17 times someone has handed me my performance review and says, sign this. It says that I've talked to you. I'm not saying that's representative, nor that that circumstance where, you know, 2 out of 19 is the number of times it's happened. But I don't think it's unusual. And I think that we have to really work with, frankly, it's basic human resources, basic work, in which you work with your supervisors and you work with your managers and you encourage them to really be serious about performance reviews and performance management.
How is the U.S. Department of Energy changing the way it does mission support? We will ask David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy. Well, David, I'd like to switch gears. You've mentioned a couple of times the department's unique environmental management cleanup efforts. And to that end, I'd like to get a sense of the progress to date. What are some of the challenges you face in this area? And how are you improving the performance in this area?
Well, let me start by trying to give a perspective on the size of the challenge. I don't know that this is the product of an official study, but in some conversations I've had with our environmental management program, when we talk and look at what remains, One estimate is that we have approximately $250 billion worth of cleanup work to do, and that it's going to take us 40 to 50 years to accomplish that work. And when you look at the size of that challenge, and if you go back and you look at the time frame of what it's going to take for us, for example, out in Hanford to build the facilities that we're currently building to get them to be operational, and once they're operational to begin to process the, you know, the 190-some enormous tanks of liquid waste that are there, we're going to be at this for quite some time. How do you do that better? I've also stated some of the challenges. You know, one of the challenges is that, you know, the U.S. government, we live in a budget-constrained world, and I don't think that's going to change in the foreseeable future. So we're trying to tackle a challenge that's a $250 billion challenge, and we're tackling it in $5 to $6 billion a year increments. And the other thing I've said is that we're also doing this in an environment where we have different states and different district courts regulating what happens at each of our sites. One of the cumulative effects of that is that we don't really do what I would call a risk-based approach to tackling this challenge. We're not in a position where, as a department, we can go out and assess what we believe the greatest risk is from the standpoint of the waste that's there and the situation in which that waste is there, and assess what's the potential for that waste to leak into groundwater, to contaminate groundwater, to contaminate the environment, how safe and secure is the way in which it's being maintained now, et cetera, and basically do an assessment and really, if you will, tackle the greatest risk first, et cetera. We're not in a position to do that. But I would say when you said how do you go about doing it is we try and do that to the maximum extent that we can. And so within the confines of trying to put together a budget and dealing with our regulatory milestones and obligations, I'd say one of the ways that we face that challenge is to really try and work at it as much as we can through a risk-based process. And then I think another thing that we're really trying to do, and this is a priority and one of the advantages of having a scientist as the secretary, is that we're trying to develop new technologies to go out and manage these wastes. And down in Savannah River, the Savannah River National Laboratory is actually the laboratory of the Environmental Management Program. Although it does a number, it does many, many different things, but one of its primary reasons for being set up was to develop new technologies that can come up with better ways to process this waste. And I'm not enough of a scientist. If I started to try and use the scientific terms to describe it, I would embarrass myself. But there's a number of areas where we've come up with new solvents, for example, where we can take out a contaminant out of a waste stream 4 to 5 times more efficiently than the previous one. And at the scale at which we're doing, that saves tens and eventually hundreds of millions of dollars as we process that. Or we've got new ways where we can put barriers between chromium that happens to be buried in some soils near rivers. We've got new ways to put barriers between that contaminant and the groundwater and sometimes the river that are much more efficient than what we've been using. And provide us an interim bridge to be able to get to the full cleanup of those contaminants. So I'd say that, and the Secretary has indicated, and it's one of his priorities as we move forward, to try and find funds so that we can, instead of just meeting the immediate milestones of what's required and the immediate day-to-day requirements of that program, that we can find ways to fund the development of these new technologies that usually are, I mean, groundbreaking is probably, you know, not meant to be a pun, but it really is. We and a couple other nations face these problems. And so, you know, in many cases, they're first-of-a-kind technologies, and it's research and work that's not being done anywhere else.
So, David, would you tell us more about your efforts at the Department of Energy to identify and dispose of excess of real property? What are you doing in the area of real property management?
One of our priorities, and I think just put a context to it, when I described the start of the department as having started in three remote places, Los Alamos, Hanford, Washington, and Oak Ridge, and we've expanded just by the nature of our mission, we've actually expanded to fairly remote places. I sometimes refer to the department as the Department of Inconvenient Places, and it's actually on purpose when you understand the mission, and particularly when you understand the secrecy with which the mission was started. And what's happened over time is that we have really substantial facilities, and communities have grown up around our facilities that are very much integrated with and dependent upon the Department of Energy. And as we've reduced the mission in terms of our commitment to nuclear weapons production and development is substantially down, and we're not running the facilities that we used to when we are downsizing. And so we are working as best we can to reduce our footprint. And as we reduce our footprint, we work with our communities to try and help them get the land and transfer land over to them where they see that they've got a need for it and it can be put to greater economic development and to help the community. We've just had two instances of it down in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. We transferred one parcel of land recently that I went down for and was pleased to be able to transfer back to the community. They've actually got an industrial park that's developed in Oak Ridge that's really quite productive. We're working with them because there's actually a really interesting new high-tech manufacturing facility that the Oak Ridge area is competing for, and the department is working with the Oak Ridge Community Development Organization to help them identify land and insofar as we can move forward with them to try and if in fact they prevail in terms of attracting that big investment. And part of why they actually want the investment, I think I may have said earlier that we consume 10% of the electric power produced in the United States. Our facilities are surrounded by a lot of the infrastructure that new plants and manufacturing facilities would like to have. And I think that makes that's part of why our facilities, if we, you know, when we're not using them, we can turn them over to communities that they become attractive. The city of Oak Ridge also is interested in building an airport. And they've talked to us, and we're talking with them as best we can about the potential to turn over some of that land for the community. But before we do that, we have to make sure, one, that all of the contamination on those facilities, on that land is cleaned, then that it's safe and that we can do so responsibly and also consistent with our obligations to all the other taxpayers of America, where that land has an economic value. If there's an economic value and we can transfer it there, or frankly, we can trade some of that land over in exchange for someone may want to use some of our land and as for economic development, and in exchange, they build a facility for us. So we're trying to use that land as a resource. We do that directly. We work with GSA to do that. But that's really, you know, one of the things that happens when the scale of the operations, by the nature of what it is smaller than it used to be.
Well, speaking about resources, and since you brought up GSA, I'd like to talk about your efforts to transform the department's contract management function. How are you using or expanding the use of the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative?
Well, we use the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative, but it actually is one of several different strategic sourcing initiatives that we have. We use that where we can. We have GSA scales and schedules, and those are available for all sorts of purchases, and we use them where we can. We also have, for example, within our science program, which is about a $4 to $5 billion program that also has 13 national laboratories, each of which is hooked up to an industrial or university partner. The Office of Science has its own strategic sourcing initiative. And there are other ones. NNSA, or National Nuclear Security Administration, has its own strategic sourcing. And as you might guess, they might imagine they have some unique sourcing requirements. But the fact that they can do that amongst their various, across their complex, et cetera. One of the things we're trying to do, and we actually did this as part of the National Laboratory Operations Board, is one suggestion was, well, why don't we consolidate and use one of them? And what we realized is, hey, wait a minute. We've got four or five strategic sourcing consortia, if you will, that are working across our complex. What we want to do is broaden access to all of them. And if you will, in the interest of saving the taxpayers all that we can, don't just use the one strategic sourcing, whether it's GSA's strategic sourcing. We use three or four different networks. And I think that's kind of, I wouldn't be surprised if that's typical across other agencies and departments, that GSA's is a very good one, but it's not the only one.
So what are you doing, David, to attract, retain, and train highly qualified, skilled workforce and personnel?
Well, one is that we've just brought aboard or about to bring aboard a new recruitment coordinator. And we're working as part of the President's Management Council has as its initiative. One of their initiatives is in the area of exactly that, to try and figure out, you know, for senior executives, for example, to figure out ways in which we can integrate better with the way hiring is done across the economy. And some of that is, can we move away from this ECQs, et cetera, and get to perhaps resume-based applications for positions? Can we reduce the hiring time? Can we be more efficient in the way in which we do that? Another aspect of that, actually, for the department is that we have just put in place a new legislated authority that we have for hiring 400, and I guess the description in the legislation is exceptionally well-qualified individuals. We now have the new statutory authority to bring aboard scientists, engineers, project management experts, et cetera, for a period of up to 4 years in a non-competitive hiring circumstance. And we're just bringing that out. Our human capital office has put forward the processes and just established that. And a number of our programs are really excited about going out and recruiting, as I think President Kennedy said, the best and the brightest, and bringing them into government.
So I'd be remiss in not touching, under your portfolio is information technology. And I was wondering if there's anything in terms of goals or priorities you'd want to touch on in the area of IT.
Well, I think we talked a little bit about cyber. And overriding all of what we do in information technology is making sure that we have adequate cyber protections in place. And I think actually the department is one of the best in government in doing that, in part because that's one of the areas of expertise of our national laboratories. And we are developing cyber technologies that are used not just at DOE, but are being used across the private sector and across government. One of the underappreciated aspects of what the department has done is that, in fact, the department is really at the forefront of high-scale computing. Our exascale, a lot of the computers that we develop to do the simulations and a lot of the work that we do are lead the world in terms of that capacity. So, if you will, program computing that is as far ahead of, as any in government, in many respects ahead of the private sector, and leads the private sector working with it. But we also have, if you will, you know, the desktop, the day-to-day. I will say that's one of the areas that's kind of tough to keep up with is that technology is always moving so quickly that you have to figure out how to keep up with it. And I think most experts will tell you that we are at the forefront. We're sort of at the leading edge right now of where so much more is going to go into the cloud and the sort of the whole technology is going to be changing. And one of our initiatives that we're underway right now is to figure out how to structure and shape the technologies and the capacities the department has so that we are ready and in a position to take advantage of all of the advances that information technology is about to make.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Department of Energy? We will ask David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy. So, David, I talked to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies, branches of government, the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you leveraging partnerships and collaboration to improve operations?
I'll give you an example of that. And I'll go back to the national laboratories. We have an initiative called Lab to Market, and we have within thousands of patents and innovations and ideas that can help this country basically build the innovation economy that we need for the future. But we are not the marketers. That's not what we do. And so we are trying to build partnerships with the Department of Commerce, with the Small Business Administration, and with local economic development and outreach organizations so that we can create the procedures and the processes and the avenues for lab to market to actually work. And so that has to be a partnership. As I said, our expertise is in developing the ideas. It's not in marketing them or getting them out. And so that's really one of the things that we work on very strongly with the partners.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation the increase in the number of folks who are opting for retirement. It's sort of a brain drain, if you will, happening. I'd like to discuss what you're doing in the area of succession planning and building the leadership of the future.
Succession planning is something that has to happen program by program. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we can do across the department. And I think one of the things we are doing in terms of my organization, the Office of Management and Performance, which has within it the Human Capital Office, is that we are working to really pull together for those programs the information that will help them appreciate the challenge that they face. And we are also trying to put together the recruitment tools and the processes that will help them appreciate that there are ways for them to go forward and recruit the new. But I think particularly with, I think we talked a little bit about how there'd been a lag in retirements and that things hadn't happened. I think this year and the wave of retirements I think we're going to see is going to focus the minds, if you will, of the program leaders. And so we're really trying to help them get the tools to implement those changes and to move forward. The succession planning that has to happen is something that they have to do themselves because they understand their program needs and they understand.
And given the technical ramifications of those programs, they would be the best people to settle it, right?
It is. And I will tell you that the hardest part of succession planning is actually not figuring out how to replace this employee with the next one. It's to get out of the mindset of hiring who you just lost and to think about what is this program and what is this department going to be doing in 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years? And what you want to do is you want to build the workforce you need for the future. You don't want to simply replace – you don't want to assume that the professional that you just lost is exactly the set of skills that you're going to need going forward.
And I'd like to stay on the future really quickly. So what are some of the major opportunities and challenges your organization will face in the future, and how do you think you'll evolve to meet those challenges and seize those opportunities?
Well, I think the workforce challenge is one that we talked about, and I think that's going to be from the standpoint of, if you will, management and operations of the department. I think that's a key. I think a second challenge that we're going to face is the budget environment that we live in. Unfortunately, I don't think that the tight constraints and the very negative perspective that has been in the public policy debate about what government can do and should do, I think that's going to be with us for a while. And I think sort of the approach that's being taken, it's hard to do more with less when less is less and less. So I think it will be an ongoing challenge to accomplish the missions of this department and to accomplish the work of government in a resource-constrained world. But that's the reality. We can and we will do it, and I think we're doing a great job of it now. But I do think that's going to be an ongoing challenge. I think from a management standpoint, I think we need to really change the perspective, sort of rebuild the perspective that government is an attractive place to work. I think that's something that's not just the Energy Department's challenge, but it's the entire government's challenge. The good news is we've got a great workforce out there that's looking for work. If you look at the statistics on college grads, and there's a lot of them out there that are highly skilled and highly talented, and they want to work. If we do it right, we can find a way to bring them into government to accomplish some of the very important missions that we've got to do.
What advice would you give those grads if they're thinking about a career in public service?
I would tell them that you have an opportunity. I'd cite for them the statistic that I've cited probably too many times in our conversation here today, which is you've got an organization where 20% or 25% of the senior leaders in that organization aren't going to be there in 5 to 7 years. That's an opportunity for you. You're in a circumstance where you can come into government. There's a great deal of things that you can do, and that there are all sorts of opportunities for you to have a career in government in which you can move forward, or you can come into government. You know, what's the statistics? The average American changes jobs every 7 years. I think we've got to evolve government into a circumstance where people can come into government, spend some time, and go off into the private sector. Maybe they come back into government, maybe they don't. Or we get people in mid-career or towards the end of their careers and come into government. I think there's tremendous opportunities in government. And I think I personally have spent time going in, both in government and the private sector. I think there's tremendous rewards in government service, and I would encourage them to do it. And if you're frustrated by the process and it seems slow, keep going at it. You know, others have made it through the process, and I think you can too. I do think that we will find a way to hire talented people and to use the talents that you have.
Great. David, I want to thank you for joining us today, but more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.